Hey, Immigrantly family, this is Sadia Khan. I have some great news for all of you. We recently launched our newsletter, which comes out 3 times a week. It's called Hyphenly, which is our no-fluff newsletter with hot takes, heartfelt stories, and all the feels of living in between cultures. Come for the nuance, stay for the vibes. You can find the link to subscribe in our show notes. Don't forget to subscribe. Hello and welcome back to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. I'll be honest, I haven't read Rajiv Balasubramanian's books. Not yet, at least. But I watched his reels, those short, thoughtful clips where he talks about things like ambition, ego, detachment, and immigrant obsession with success. And something about his voice, calm, grounded, a little cheeky, made me stop scrolling and listening.
We had Obama, and yet now racism seems to be as strong as it was in the 80s. What is going on? Well, I think it all comes down to backlash. There's a technical term for it. It's something like majority caste dominance anxiety or something like that. It's when the most powerful group suddenly realizes that their status is under threat and they could be displaced, and they hit back hard because nobody wants to lose their status. So
how do Rajiv's not your typical author. He has a PhD, studied philosophy and politics, and walked away from academia to figure out what really matters. His content really doesn't sell self-help, but it does make you reflect on the life you're living, the expectations you've internalized, and the version of you that might exist underneath all that noise. And in this conversation, we get into all of it. Ambition, burnout, family expectations, respect, disrespect, cultural identity, spiritual seeking, and the quiet freedom in choosing not to chase what everyone else is running after. If you've ever felt like you were doing all the right things, but still felt out of sync, this episode is for you. So without further ado, let's get right into it. Hello, Rajiv. How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good.
So you were traveling, right?
I was in the UK, a lot of steam trains with my two-year-old.
How was the experience?
He loved it. I thought it was quite strange. and I had one day by myself and I went to Lourdes to watch cricket.
So it's interesting how I came across your content. Now, you've been in academia, you've studied politics, philosophy, you've written books. But my first interaction with your work was through your content on Instagram. How did it come about? How did you decide to start putting out content on Instagram?
Well, I've been thinking about it for a while. I'm working on a nonfiction book, and it seemed time to enter that space. You know, for many years, all I've been doing really is focusing on the inside, doing a lot of meditation and psychedelics and therapy. And then I kept thinking I need to start re-engaging with politics at some stage. I'd become quite apolitical, really. I was very tempted to seek some way of retiring to the forest and growing a few vegetables and just let the world burn and just hang out with my little boy. But then I think it's probably because of the little boy, really. You know, I'm 50. Life is going to go on for me. My responsibility towards life is going to go on for a few more generations, I guess. And we are in deep trouble. And I watched the inauguration, and every billionaire in America was sitting on the front row next to the, watching their champion. And then Elon Musk did the salute. And I think it was the day after that I recorded my first video.
And how's the experience been like?
It's motivation to record a video. I was doing it every day for a long time. Now I take a few days off, maybe 3 days off a week. It's the severity of the situation. India has become a fascist state. America is on its way. Britain and Germany, the far right is looking very, very strong. France, Italy, most of Asia. And it's a very urgent situation. So I started to talk about this urgent situation. And at the times I've been getting 2,000-3,000 followers a day. So it seems that there is a demand for this. And I think the reason is because it had been 15, 20 years where my focus is spirituality and healing and not politics. I think because I'm coming from it primarily from that angle. Occasionally, I just talk some straight, neat politics, but most of the time I'm mixing it with a very internal perspective. I think people are responding to that because it's obvious that we can't go on the way that we are without considering a sort of deeper wisdom, but just everybody just fighting and shouting, you know, left just abusing the right, each side seeing the other as evil. Nobody changes their politics. It doesn't work like that.
And what I've noticed about your reels is that you appear to be very calm and collected. There is some humor, but the way you deliver, the way you talk about different topics, you break them down in simple, bite-sized pieces of information. I feel like on social media, when we see so many emotions and so much back and forth floating around, just looking and watching your videos, it's calming in a way. And you've talked about how your spiritual journey has played a role into how you deliver this content. So how does spirituality play into it?
Well, I think it's rooting politics in what you could call spiritual values, in equanimity, compassion, understanding, excluding nobody. You know, it's not tribal. It's seeing the species as an organism, the planet as an organism, and seeking its well-being and rooting politics in that base. You know, if something's rooted in a good space emotionally, the result will hopefully mirror that emotional base. I didn't always think like that. In my 20s, I was just a regular leftist, I suppose, and quite angry and reactive and so on. And then I had a nervous breakdown when I was 32. And then spent what's close to 20 years now just focusing on the inside. But then a lot of people who do that, particularly in this New Age movement, are very, very apolitical. And that's a form of what we call spiritual bypassing. But it's also, for me, it was just necessary for a while. I just needed to calm down, as Taylor Swift says. That's really what I needed. I just needed to give myself some time and breathing space and just heal. You know, activists who are not healed can cause a lot of damage while technically being on the right side because their methods and their mental basis.
How so?
Because they're coming from a space of hatred and anger. And so they're really trying to harm. They're trying to defeat. They're losing their compassionate base. Because they're so wrapped up in their own pain and trauma. So I needed to look at that first before I engaged through that.
Do you think anger as an emotion is problematic, or the way it's weaponized is the problem?
I don't think any emotion is problematic. Emotions are who we are, and we have the whole spectrum. We can't stop them. We have no control over the arising and passing. I just think you need to be able to observe them and take a step back from them and be able to look at them rather than instantly reacting. It's when we instantly react that the problems start to arise.
So Rajiv, how do you stop yourself from instantly reacting?
The last close to 20 years, that's what the kind of meditation I do was very helpful because you're observing your sensations on your body. Anger arises as a sensation. And if you can look at it, then you can give yourself a little space, you know, between the, it was T.S. Eliot poem, but between the emotion and the response, that's what it is. Therapy helped a lot, recognizing that you're constantly occupying different spaces within an emotional spectrum and that none is good or bad, but you can move. You don't have to get trapped in a particular part of your mind map. And I think working with trauma, you know, because the other two are sort of surface in a way. It's your reaction to what's happening right now. Trauma is you reacting to the past. So excavating that past and recognizing that most of the time when you're angry, if not all the time, you're not angry about what's actually happening in front of you. The emotions are not coming from there. The emotions are coming from the past. Your ego, if you like, is trying to warn you about a danger that actually isn't there.
You've talked about ego a lot. Like, you often question whether ego is always a bad thing. How do you define ego in your spiritual practice? And how has your understanding of ego evolved?
Initially, I suppose, you know, people say you have a big ego, right? It means you're kind of big-headed, arrogant. But, you know, there's the Freudian definition where Freud saw it as the rational adult who mediates between your childlike, unstoppable desires and the moral policeman in your head, your sort of critical parent. He was uncritical of it. He saw it as something to strengthen. But then there's the more religious spiritual definition where, you know, the devil is basically the ego in Christianity, or right, or Mara in Buddhism. You know, it's the part inside of, you know, in the Abrahamic religions, it's the, you know, that little fellow with a pitchfork. It's responsible for every negative thought. That's the way I would describe the ego. And it's the part of the mind that believes that you are separate. And the ego can persuade you to play small. It doesn't have to be, you know, big-headed and so on. It can say very negative things about yourself and does constantly. Or it can say negative things about other people. It feeds on fear. But I also do think that it is trying to protect you. I just think that it's misguided.
So how does it protect you?
Well, if a dog has bitten you, then it will say, don't go anywhere near dogs. And actually, this is obviously a sort of slightly, it's obviously a very apolitical example, but then, you know, you're losing the fun of playing with dogs. And not every dog is going to bite you. Most of them are not going to bite you. But your ego is trying to convince you they're all going to bite you. So that's basically it. You know, I think I used the example in one of my videos. It could be that you're about to go on a podcast and the ego says, why don't you just cancel? Because most likely you'll make a fool of yourself, or you'll be asked questions that you won't be able to answer and you're not good enough anyway. And if you listen to the ego every time, it's very self-defeating.
When is a good time to listen to the ego?
All the time is a good time to be aware of it, but the ego's never saying anything valid, but got to be aware of its voice all the time. And its voice is ever present as long as you're alive. You know, maybe truly enlightened beings, does that mean you don't have an ego? Or does that mean you have an ego, but you give it zero credence? Perhaps that, I don't know what it means, but I just think being aware of it, but not acting on it and not taking it seriously and recognizing that it's this unintelligent, unwise, deeply wounded part of you that you would be ill-advised to listen to or take seriously.
Rajiv, I saw one of your latest reels, and that really struck me because I have grown up in a culture where we talk about respect and disrespect a lot, especially respecting your elders. But you don't believe in that. You think when elders demand respect, they are trying to control you. Why are you so skeptical of the concept or the notion of respect as it's practiced, especially in Eastern cultures?
Because you can't demand respect. It's just illogical. You either respect the person or you don't. You can't tell someone to respect you. So, and if they don't respect you, there may well be a good reason for it. And it certainly wasn't a child who came up with the dictate to respect your elders. It's just another form of patriarchy. I think that a truly loving parent, usually the child will respect them. And I'm not talking about blind obedience or submission, which is really what the word means in the traditional South Asian context. It usually means obedience, which I think is a very dangerous thing. And you should respect the child. Respect the child. The child is much more likely to respect you.
Talk to me about your relationship with your parents. What was that dynamic like, especially in the context of respect?
It was a fairly standard South Asian dynamic. The parents wanted respect, but didn't respect the child. It meant that I rebelled. It was either felt like rebellion or some kind of internal death. I rebelled for a long time. It's good for me, but you have to, at some point, become an adult. And when you are an adult, then you don't need to rebel anymore. Once you feel in charge of yourself, and that's really a trauma thing, is when you're able to stand up to the people that you're afraid of. You're able to stand up to authority, not in a quixotic way, not, you know, punching a policeman or something, you know, self-destructive. But when you're able to stand up intelligently, rationally, sensibly, when it's no longer a terrifying thing to do, then I think you lose the tag of a rebel.
Has your relationship with your parents evolved over the years? Has that dynamic changed now?
It has, yes. But I mean, the way that it's changed is that I don't get so hurt by them if they disrespect me, because I've learned certain techniques about giving self-love when love is not given. And I don't need anything from them emotionally. To parent yourself, to parent the child inside of you is important.
How do you do that?
By being aware that there's a hurt child inside of you at all times, and by giving that child love. It's sort of imaginative thing, but I can feel that child inside of me. If I look, I can feel him there all the time and see him actually a lot of the time. And there's also the inner teenager, which is also very important. I think that, you know, really it's the small child and the teenager who get hurt the most. And that's the period where we were developing most rapidly. And so to give them as much love and nurturing and, you know, unconditional love, so they can trust you 100%, so that you love them 100%.
Do you think there is such a thing as unconditional love, though? I feel like love is, to some extent, transactional.
I would say I love my 2-year-old unconditionally, whatever he does. I think it's positive.
How about your relationship with your child? How have you started to respect him?
I think it was there from day one. It was a curious thing that when he was born, it was a very strange thing. When you're looking at him and it's like staring at the sun, he's just born. And I had a couple of thoughts that I've never, ever had again. No, one thought really, which is, I resent you, your life is going to be so much better than mine. And I never had that thought again. And it was like, you know, sort of burped out with me. It was a very strange thing. And since then, it's just never been there. I suspect it's that inner child work that's made that happen. I mean, I think about the things that I would not like him to be in life.
What are some of the things you wouldn't want him to be?
I mean, the obvious ones, right? Serial killer. Some kind of pedophile. You know? But also, you know, if he became a fascist, but I would hope that love would be uncontaminated. But nonetheless, there would be a lot of anguish. Part of a parent is you have to have some sort of moral, what do you call them? With AI, guardrails, you call them. And, you know, I'm already teaching him, you know, don't hit people. And, you know, don't throw sand in people's faces. And so, you know, it's ouchy, that hurts. It hurts when you slap dada in the face. So, you know, I don't want him to hit other children. I want him to be considerate. I want him to be kind.
You've in fact talked about how fascism begins at home but ends with good parenting. And it seems that you're very intentional about making sure that it ends with good parenting. Explain to me, what do you mean by that? Like, how you connect the personal with the political? How do you ensure that your kid doesn't end up being a fascist? How does anybody ensure that?
Well, I think bullying and authoritarian parenting generates so much rage in a child that continues into adult life, and the rage needs to go somewhere. And most of the people I've met with somewhat fascist sensibilities, no matter what the brand, it could be neo-Nazis, jihadists, fundamentalists, whatever the brand, they appear to have been bullied quite severely in childhood or neglected. Sometimes it's some form of abuse, usually, and it doesn't necessarily come from parents, but bullying from the father, often neglect is a big one, because it creates this desire for people who love you, for a tribe, which makes you susceptible to cults and fascism. And it makes you feel unlovable. So you're constantly trying to prove yourself. You want to prove your manhood or prove your worth or legitimacy, and all of that can make someone quite susceptible to, yeah, some form of fundamentalism. A person who's at ease with themselves, who doesn't need to prove themselves, who doesn't need to be a rock star or a celebrity or a billionaire, is more likely to have same views, circumspect.
But some would classify that as ambition, right? Wanting to be somebody or wanting to be something. Do you think having ambition is bad?
When it comes from a space of lack, I think it's a symptom of a wound. That desperate drive to be somebody, because you already are somebody. Or to, you know, like, my life will begin when I make it. Your life is here right now. To have ambitions that don't come from a space of lack, but where you want to do good, or you want to achieve something worthwhile, that's different. I still have ambitions, I suppose. I don't call them ambitions, usually. They're still things that I want to do. I don't have that void inside of me that I used to have, where I felt that I need to be somebody other than I am, or that if I don't achieve these ambitions, then my life is a waste of time, or I'm nobody.
You've also been critical of immigrant ambition. As an immigrant who moved to the U.S. almost 20 years ago, I can see how immigrants are so fixated on being somebody or achieving something, because that's how their worth is measured in the country that they adopt as home. Why do you think that may be problematic?
Well, a lot of that is low self-esteem. It often comes from racism, from a feeling that people don't want you there, that you don't belong. You're living your life through somebody else's eyes to please somebody else, to gain acceptance. It doesn't work.
But in most instances, people do not want you there. That's a fact, right? That there is a lot of racism in countries like the US and UK. So how do you think people should, especially immigrants, deal with that? Like, how do they reconcile that dichotomy?
Well, the important thing is not to believe those negative messages that are coming at you, and not to start to see yourself through racist eyes, and then you have poor self-esteem and self-hatred, and you're constantly trying to fight against that. Well, that's ego again, that demon inside of your mind. The important thing is to love yourself and not to worry about other people's twisted perceptions.
Talk to me about self-love. You've mentioned it a few times. How do you love yourself?
Well, it's been a long journey. I also had a lot of those very negative messages and grew up with constant racism, constant daily racism. So first step, to identify that you don't love yourself, which most people don't realize. You know, that was the first thing that I learned after my very first meditation course, long meditation course. Almost instantly, I could see that there was a lot of self-hatred there. So I had to look it, go in and see what that was all about. Uncover the source of it, actually, which is in childhood. I took through a lot of anger, actually, a lot of anger, years of it, which I went through in meditation cells a lot, and fear, and to see all of that fear and shame, deep, deep shame, And to recognize that that was why I was the way I was, I had a huge sense of shame and a core belief that I was unlovable. And then slowly to unpack that and to learn self-love. The inner child work helped a lot. Psychedelics helped a lot. Meditation helped a lot. Therapy helped a lot. It was everything. That's really, if you ask me one core goal of spiritual practice, what is it all about? That's probably it, right?
Rajiv, you've also talked about self-love in the context of culture itself, right? A lot of us gravitate towards cultural markers or cultural identifiers. We gravitate towards people who look like us, who have same accents, who speak the same language, who follow same traditions. But you think it's better to self-love and create a new community that's outside of those boundaries. But we do feel threatened by people who don't look like us, and we feel comfortable around folks who are similar to us. That's human nature. I mean, we call it tribalism, but it is a reality. How do we unlearn that?
Well, that's the entire role of spirituality, right? Is to unlearn hating the other, is to unlearn hatred itself, fear, these baser instincts, so they don't control us anymore. The need to create weapons of mass destruction and unleash them at the infidel. You know, this is really what we're here to do, is to unlearn all of this. That's our purpose. I don't trust identity or culture or ideology at all. I think that they cause tremendous problems. And I'm not convinced by this argument that it's my culture, therefore I'll be like this, or I'm proud of my culture, I think this is all part of our giant problem of grandiosity and fixed viewpoints and rigidity in thinking and our inability to see ourselves as a species and an organism, and blocking us from universal love and compassion and for being, you know, truly flexible beings. I think these things pin us down. I think they weigh us down. They act like unnecessary baggage. I'm very fond of quoting Terence McKenna, who a man I was very fond of, who said, "Culture is not your friend." And I think that's a very good point. People don't like it when I say this. It's not a popular opinion, unfortunately. People are, especially now, very attached to their identities. But once again, I think it's part of ego.
You're right. It may be part of ego, but it also, in some ways, manifests in compassion and love, because when we connect with a certain identity, we are really reinforcing our sense of self in some ways, because even if we were to detach ourselves from those identity markers, other people are not. That's how the world is structured. So for us to divorce ourselves from this idea of identity, everybody else will have to do the same for it to be effective.
Well, I think if we don't do that, we're going to go extinct. We're going to blow each other apart. The level of military technology now is so astounding. The other day, I was in the Lake District in the UK with my two-year-old, and these fighter jets flew past. Like, everybody was just staring at these creatures as if they were aliens from another galaxy. And somebody who knew what he was talking about said they cost $800 million each to make. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. You know, this is the level of military technology, chemical weaponry, germ warfare, and of course, nuclear weapons that we have. And everybody is so defended and so guarded and is full of love only for their own little corner of the world and their own little tribe, and to hell with the rest. And if we continue in that direction, I think it's going to be the end. I think we have to create a new culture based on universality and species consciousness.
So how about we stick to those identifiers to some extent, but then we open ourselves to accepting other cultural affiliations or being more receptive to who other people are. Like, we don't have to diminish ourselves to accept somebody else, right? We could hold on to our identities and yet be more receptive to identities that are different from us. Can those two things coexist?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's a very important first step. All right, let me change my angle of going at this to look at it less from a sort of real world political perspective and just say that in my meditation, you know, I've had certain experiences which made it very, very clear to me that I'm not my identity, that that just simply isn't who I am, that I'm not my ego, that I'm not this construct. Rajiv does not exist. And once I had that experience the first time, it was after my first solo meditation retreat on top of a mountain in California. It was really, really good for a few weeks. And after that, my interest in identity and culture lessened greatly when I could see it was just something the ego, the constructed self-concept was clinging to, but it wasn't real. And then after I think my first session, I had 8 sessions of MDMA therapy. MDMA is, you know, the active component in the street drug ecstasy, but it's a therapeutic aid. It's very, very powerful. And I think after the first one, that was when I realized that culture, ideology, and identity were things that we couldn't do to make us feel good about ourselves or to make us feel that we have a connection with particular individuals, whereas actually we have a connection to everything. And it's this sort of ultimate truth that I am in pursuit of. And I've had glimpses of it. That's all, just glimpses. And those glimpses are enough to lead me to have this perspective on cultural identity and ideology.
Yeah, full disclosure, I can't see it right now. What I can see is being more empathetic towards other identities. And that's something that I've always advocated for. Because again, the roadblock that I have is, if I were to forego all of it, people would still see me as an embodiment of something, right? No matter how much I try, people still see me as a Muslim woman, somebody of Pakistani origin, having an accent, being an immigrant in America, having multiplicity of cultures. And I feel like embracing it is in a way empowering, because then I'm like, okay, this is how people see me. I feel empowered by recognizing those different facets of who I am and yet being receptive to who other people are. But it's a very fascinating exercise, right? Focusing beyond those markers and looking at humanity as a whole. And now that I've had this conversation with you, I will try intentionally.
Well, what I found is that because I'm no longer seeing myself as all of these things, like very little. I'm not wandering around thinking people are going to see me as brown or Indian, or they might have some racist response, or they're going to judge me by my accent as, you know, British, whatever. You know, because I've let go of all of that. What I'm finding is that people are much faster to see the part of me that is really me. And I'm losing that fear of that. There are more connections I'm seeing with people, just who we are. I'm finding that happens much more quickly now. It's what I'm projecting. It's a relationship. So the way other people perceive you is not fixed, and there are several billion of those other people, and they all perceive you in a different way according to their level of consciousness. And it was a friend of mine once heard Krishnamurti speak. By the way, I rarely understand a word Krishnamurti says, but he seems very impressive. And he said it was like something back here, something inside of you communicating with something inside of him, the kind of eternal part of you. I guess that's what I'm getting towards. It's not a popular opinion. People really don't seem to like it. But I think that the closer we can move towards that, the more of a chance we have of existing in 100 years' time.
I don't think for me, it's about disliking the concept. It's a fascinating concept. I think conceptualization and execution are two different things. So how do we execute is where I find it difficult to comprehend how I will execute it. And I'll give you an example. I recently went back to Pakistan after 4 years. I had not been back. And I was feeling guilty that it had been so long since I last went. And the minute I landed, I felt right at home. I didn't have to learn anything or get adjusted. Although I've lived here for so long, I don't go back as often. And I felt so much at home. Everything seemed the same it was 20 years ago. And it can't be. Things have moved on and people have changed. But I felt like I was where I had left initially. But the only caveat was 2 weeks into it, I was like, oh, I want to go back home now. And the idea of home, my home in New York, it wasn't Pakistan. Although I felt so comfortable in Pakistan. And that's where I think different identities just mesh over time. And just doing away with all of that is scary.
It's very scary.
Because then you feel like you've been stripped naked. And how do you deal with that? I've held on to those identities for so long. I don't know if I can practice it like you do. But I think just knowing the concept is so fascinating to me.
Well, I haven't gone all the way with it. I'm sort of stuck.
So let me ask you this. What parts of your identity are you still holding on to subconsciously, consciously?
The strongest one now is probably as a father. That's probably my strongest identity. As a man, it seems difficult to get rid of when you interact with the world, your gender, although obviously people are working on that. British is not so strong. Weirdly, Indian is harder to get rid of than I thought because it just keeps showing up in my fiction. And writing fiction, I can't seem to get rid of it. So I'm not sure.
Is it because of how other people perceive you or how you see your Indianness? Like, why do you think it is stronger or harder to get rid of?
I think it's what I know. I think that the behavior in particular of Indian families is what I really know. It's difficult to really know something unless you've been inside a family, I think. So that's a little trickier. And it's not that I'm actively trying to sort of remove it. I'm trying to find out who I am. And these things kind of fall away.
What's been the easiest to let go?
None of it was easy. None of it has been very easy. I remember letting go of political ideology, identity politics, and a sort of very strong attachment to the left, and just saying, okay, how about I just don't call myself any of these things and just see what I think at each given time, even though I have the sort of training and vocabulary, you know, that's useful, but I just don't position myself like that anymore, so that I don't have to have a particular response. I can just do whatever, and I can listen to conservatives and listen to people on the right without judging them and seeing them as the enemy. That, after my first MDMA therapy session, that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that was the one that I remember disappeared quite spectacularly. I think along with that was my sort of feeling that white people are constantly judging me and being racist, and therefore I have to embed myself in a POC identity. That one kind of disappeared too. I lost that fear, which radically changes the way that you interact with society. You can smile a lot more.
Yeah, you're right.
It's not gone completely. When I'm in certain parts of Britain, it'll come back, but usually temporarily.
I think if I were to let go of any, I think that would be the first one, because before coming to the US, I wasn't conscious about, you know, not being white. And my dad even doesn't like the term white. He gets really annoyed when I use it. He always corrects me and says, you should say Europeans or Western Europeans or classify it differently. But when I came to the US, I feel like that was taught. That's something that I learned as an adult, not as a kid, because I grew up in Pakistan predominantly, you know, being part of a dominant majority, unfortunately, lends itself to certain privileges, and all those privileges accrued to me growing up in Pakistan. So I feel like that was something I learned in the US. I don't feel as strongly about it at times, but then, as you said, certain interactions with people in the US, or like people in my town or in society in general, make me more aware of that dichotomy. But I think the hardest would be my Pakistani or South Asian identity or my Muslim identity. I think those identities are so ingrained in who I am. So here's my question. If anybody listening to this were to try unlearning some of it, where should they start? What is the starting point?
Again, I'm not sure if unlearning is exactly the right way to go about it. I think it's more learning who we really are. And I think the starting point is always observation of the mind. Just keep looking and keep asking the question, who is doing the observing? Who are you? Okay, if I'm Indian, who is making that judgment? Who is saying I'm Indian? Who is saying I? And just keep going. Everything starts to unravel once you ask those questions. It's very difficult to hold on to identity when you're sincerely asking that question. Is almost impossible. You're left with nothing. Who is asking? Who is it?
That's my Prime delivery.
What, already?
Only one thing can match the buzz of Prime's fast delivery. And that's the buzz of Prime's entertainment.
What are we watching?
Heads of State, that new action comedy with Idris Elba as the Prime Minister, John Cena as the President, and Priyanka Chopra Jonas as their only hope. Looks like a blast.
From fast delivery to explosive entertainment, it's on Prime. For only $8.99 a month, join now. Content includes limited ads, subscription auto-renews. For more information, go to amazon.co.uk/prime.
Rajiv, we started with your content. If you weren't creating this content or writing, as you mentioned, how would you be expressing your curiosity today? Are there any other tools that you may use?
I think I would either pursued some sort of, maybe become a Buddhist monk or some kind of life of that kind, priest, would have gone in that direction, or psychotherapy. I would have trained as a psychotherapist in one school or another, which I think is a really important and necessary profession.
Is that something that you see in your future?
No, I don't think so. I think I've gone too far down this path, and I like writing, and I've worked hard to improve my skill at it. And so I think I should probably stick to what I'm doing. I did think about it a few years ago. I came very close to doing something about that, but yeah, time is limited.
So what's next for you in writing?
Well, I'm now working on a nonfiction book about everything I'm talking about, but really about what should we do as a species if we are going to prevent self-annihilation. And I think we need to have this revolution in consciousness. So that's what the book is about. You know, it's really everything that I've been talking about. And I think that, you see, the thing is, a lot of this, I probably would have kept it all to myself, because a lot of my opinions are not that popular, and people can feel, I've had messages saying people feel that I'm making people feel guilty for having identity and so on. I'm not trying to make anyone feel guilty, but or very aggressive, you know, when I start going after Hindu fundamentalism, which, you know, it's interesting why that pisses me off the most, because that's my own background. So that's where that's from too, right? I'm a South Indian Brahmin family, so it makes me really mad. And that's, you know, it's a little piece of ego in there. But the reason why I want to push this and to try and, you know, not to start at such extreme levels, but just to work through it slowly as a kind of handbook to changing the mind, is that I think if we don't do this, we are going to go either extinct or be reduced to some sort of pitiable post-apocalyptic state. It's coming. This is The crisis is, the apocalypse feasibly is already upon us. The Third World War is already upon us. You know, it's happening. You know, I think we've had our Franz Ferdinand moment. It's right here. So, you know, and I feel that the change has to come in the mind first. I don't think that all of this political haranguing on the internet or throwing tomato soup at a Van Gogh painting, it doesn't seem to be having the desired effect. So I think that if we're going to save our species, we have to evolve in terms of consciousness and do that work without turning our back on engagement in society.
So we started with why you started posting content on Instagram. One of the triggers was Trump's inauguration this year. And we'll end with a question about the United States of America. So if you were to define it in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Well, I would say that it's the expression of the ego and of our individualism and grandiosity. And I think it's quite childish. It's quite a childish urge, a sort of grand libidinous urge. It appeals to me. I've always really enjoyed being in the US, and there are things about it I absolutely love, but it is a bit like a child with an ice cream, you know, a 2-liter bottle of Coke with an ice cream floating on top. I guess that's the way I would see it. It's
I love it.
It's not going to last.
Thank you so much, Ajit. We finally finished our interview after some logistical, technical issues. Where can people find your content on Instagram? I'm a huge fan and you have a huge followership. But for those who don't know, what is your Instagram handle? Where can they find your content?
At Rajiv Writer. Rajiv is RAJEEV. And I'm on Instagram and TikTok. At Rajiv Writer.
Thank you so much, Rajiv. This was wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
You know what? This episode was challenging logistically. We had some technical issues. The call dropped out a few times. But Rajiv and I were persistent. We made it happen. And I hope you enjoyed the end product, which is our wonderful conversation. If you liked it, please share it with friends. A lot of time, energy, effort goes into producing these great conversations. And the biggest compliment you can give us is either share, like, or subscribe to our channel on Apple Podcasts, Immigrantly Uninterrupted, where you get content uninterrupted, ad-free, for a very small subscription fee. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another guest. Take care and be kind to yourselves and to others.